We do believe that Kim Jong-un, given these tool sets, would use them for things besides simply regime protection.
North Korea's weapons of mass coercion. It's Thursday, January 25th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Indonesia displays military dexterity. Difficulty sending Rohingya home. The next episode of Star Wars, not in theaters. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The director of the Central Intelligence Agency has said North Korea's nuclear weapons are for more than just regime preservation, but also as a tool of coercion. Speaking at the Washington-based American Enterprise Institute think tank, Mike Pompeo said Pyongyang is still months away from holding America at risk, but the CIA director said the North's testing capacity and frequency of successful outcomes have both improved, moving them closer to a point where Americans are at risk. He said Kim Jong-un will not rest with a single successful test, but is driving to possess a nuclear arsenal capable of multiple firings of missiles simultaneously.
It is more than just regime preservation that we are concerned he will use. We talk about the nuclear risk all the time. That gets the brunt of the world's attention, and appropriately so. But his conventional forces alone, right, close to a million under arms, depending on how you count them, is no small thing. We do believe that Kim Jong-un, given these tool sets, would use them for things besides simply regime protection. Mm-hmm. And that is to put pressure on what is his ultimate goal, which is reunification of the peninsula under his authority. And so we don't think it's the case that he's simply going to use this tool set for self-preservation. We think he'll use it in a way that is either, you call it what you will, call it coercive, is perhaps the best way to think about how Kim Jong-un is prepared to potentially use these weapons.
Pompeo said while President Donald Trump's focus is a diplomatic solution, the intelligence community is preparing a series of options to make sure the president has a full sweep of possibilities should diplomacy fail. Melissa Hannum, a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies in California, tells VOA's Victor Beatty she believes North Korea can already coerce its neighbors and thus increase its provocations with impunity.
With regard to firing multiple missiles at the United States, we already know that they've been doing salvo missile testing of their Nodong and Scud missiles towards the east in approximately the direction of Japan. So we've already seen them doing this sort of salvo missile testing, and there are already many American lives on bases in Japan.
He also expressed concern about the capability of proliferating to other countries.
I think that's always a concern. North Korea was one of the larger proliferators of Scud and Nodong missiles in the 90s, and that gradually waned off. But it's not out of the realm of possibility that they would try to export their missile capabilities and their WMD again. I think the U.S. has had an effective campaign to pressure other countries to not buy from North Korea. And really, I think that in order for North Korea to overcome those capabilities, they're going to have to be even more crafty in their shipping and their other methods of transmitting those types of technologies.
Melissa Hannum commends the CIA director for not pushing for a limited military strike against North Korea. With limited options, she says the CIA has been up against even more lethal adversaries before, and that is what faces the United States once again. Later on VOA Asia, we look at the North Korean nuclear threat amid some interest in a 30-year-old proposal. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Indonesian special forces woo Mattis with snakes and blood drinking. UNICEF says Myanmar must guarantee protection of Rohingya refugees. Internet access booming in least developed countries. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on the internet, on Facebook at VOA Asia, and on our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Biting off snake heads and drinking blood, Indonesia's special forces put on a show to impress U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis during a visit to the island nation to boost U.S. cooperation with Indonesia's military. Indonesian special forces put on an elaborate counterterrorism demonstration for the visiting Mattis, and you can see some of that dramatic and entertaining video on VOA Asia Facebook. Mattis observed the 20-minute demonstration alongside a senior Indonesian military official at the country's armed forces headquarters. The U.S. military is looking to boost counterterrorism cooperation with Indonesia to deepen ties with Southeast Asian nations and counter China's influence during a trip to the region. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff has more from Washington.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told his Indonesian counterpart that the U.S. military is willing to work with the country's Kopassus Special Forces Unit. Once accused of torture and other rights abuses, Mattis says the group has since reformed and can help in the counterterrorism fight.
We know that we can learn a lot from them, and we must work together on this larger problem.
Mattis's visit to Jakarta comes as Indonesia looks to modernize its military and is more willing to push back against China's territorial claims.
We can help in maintaining the maritime domain awareness in the South China Sea, the North Natuna Sea. This is something that we look forward to doing.
But Turkey was also on the mind of the U.S. Defense Secretary on Tuesday. Mattis told reporters traveling with him that the Turkish offensive against the YPG, the U.S.-allied Kurdish militia in Syria, is a potential distraction in the fight against the Islamic State terror group. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson resigned Wednesday from an international board that advises Myanmar on the Rohingya crisis, charging the panel was not committed to change in the Southeast Asian country. Richardson, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and energy secretary in the Bill Clinton administration, quit in the midst of the board's first visit to Western Rakhine State, where nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled the military crackdown on insurgents. Richardson said Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi was deficient in moral leadership, an accusation that came 2 days after a meeting with her and other board members. Richardson said he and Suu Kyi got into an argument when he mentioned the case of two Reuters reporters covering the crisis who are on trial on accusations of violating laws to protect state secrets. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. Azeem Ibrahim, research professor at the U.S. Army War College and author of a book titled The Rohingyas Inside Myanmar's Genocide. He tells Melman he was not surprised at this latest development.
Not at all. I've actually, during the course of the research of my book, which took 2.5 years, I met dozens of people who have had lengthy interactions with Aung San Suu Kyi. Many of them have known her for a long time, decades in some cases, and known her intimately. For example, I interviewed people who used to smuggle papers to her in prison. I also interviewed the founder of the Free Aung San Suu Kyi campaign. And all of them, without exception, all told me the same thing. She's a Buddhist nationalist that believes that Myanmar is a country that's exclusively for the Buddhist, that just happens to have minorities within it. She has set up a number of these kinds of commissions, including the Kofi Annan Commission and many others that are simply set up to try to pacify international opinion, and they have actually no intention whatsoever to implement any of the recommendations these commissions actually provide. So this is a number of people have told me, leaders of NGOs, politicians, policymakers, that she's completely indifferent to the suffering of minorities within her country.
Are you saying this whole thing is a set-up scam by her?
I think many of the signs were there that she's always been a Burma Buddhist nationalist. And even when she was in prison, it's just the fact that we in the West like to ignore many of these signs. We like to believe that these people, we put them on a pedestal because they speak like us and they have fantastic stories, you know, and her story is one of the best. Oxford educated, speaks the Queen's English, she's beautiful, articulate, she's going to go back to her country, to her former country. So we give these people lots of leeway without realizing that they're actually ideologically committed to their own cause. And she, like almost all the elite in Myanmar, have always believed that this is a Buddhist country, and many of the minorities just do not belong there.
And now there is apparently has been an agreement to repatriate hundreds of thousands of Rohingya back to Myanmar. However, that's been delayed. What's the latest that you know about this?
There's not much appetite to take them back. However, I do believe that in the past, what's happened 2016 and it also in the 1990s is that they take back maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand families as a token gesture. But all of those families are actually moved into permanent, what they call temporary internment camps. But in reality, they all just become permanent concentration camps. And I visited those myself. And that's all they are. They're open-air concentration camps surrounded by barbed wire in which none of the Rohingya can actually leave.
How does this come to an end? How is this resolved, if it can be resolved?
I don't think there's any easy solution to this. You know, I believe that the only solution to this is for the international community to put considerable more pressure on Myanmar, including sanctions and other kinds of penalties, and force them to amend their laws.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. Azeem Ibrahim, a research professor at the U.S. Army War College and author of a book titled The Rohingyas Inside Myanmar's Genocide. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia. In a feat of manpower and perseverance, some 1,500 Chinese construction workers have built a railway station in less than 9 hours. The Yongyang Station is part of the railway line being developed to connect the Yangtze River Delta and the Pearl River Delta. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, scientists and NASA officials who spearheaded development of a space-based missile defense system in the 1980s are urging its revival to counter emerging nuclear threats from North Korea and other rogue states. The controversial U.S. Space Defense Initiative, SDI, started under President Ronald Reagan and was often ridiculed as Star Wars by critics in the U.S. Congress and media who balked at its high cost. The program never got past the drawing board and was largely abandoned at the end of the Cold War amid significant technological shortcomings. But now NASA experts say commercially available space technology currently produced by Tesla and other contractors would lower development costs and shorten deployment time. But as in the 1980s, the task remains extremely complicated for current technology. Michael O'Hanlon, a foreign policy analyst at the Brookings Institution, says the odds of shooting down a North Korean missile in mid-flight are probably 25% to 50% at best. O'Hanlon says hitting a North Korean nuclear research facility will not halt weapons development, as Pyongyang has numerous nuclear sites. Instead, it could induce a massive nuclear meltdown that could put at risk the lives of millions in the region.
And so we could miss. We could wind up embarrassing ourselves. We could wind up having our interceptor land in a place it wasn't supposed to. It's just not clear we'll be successful. You're going to spew radioactivity over a large swath of North Korea. I don't think that's a viable option for the United States on strategic or moral grounds.
Security analyst Daniel Pinkston, who is a lecturer in international relations with Troy University in Seoul, says there is also a high risk that North Korea would retaliate against a limited U.S. strike by attacking South Korea or Japan.
I think it would be very reckless, and I think would actually alienate the allies and challengers in the region. It would marginalize the U.S. So from a U.S. foreign policy perspective, I think that's a mistaken view and has a number of risks involved.
Imposing a U.S. naval blockade of North Korea to enforce international sanctions has also been advocated as a possible third option. But such a move would be considered an international act of war and possibly provoke a military confrontation with North Korean, Chinese, or even Russian ships. Our thanks to VOA correspondent Brian Padden and Yomi Kim in Seoul for contributing this report. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll always find us streaming on VOA Asia Facebook. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us a message on Facebook or an email at voaasia@voanews.com. There's one other place you can listen to us. If you happen to be in Myanmar, check out us on Facebook at VOA Burmese. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Rob McLean for getting today's program on the air, managing editor Diane Gao, David Bird, Ira Melman, and Skylar Ogden on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.